It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The talk on the perfection of concentration is inspired by Tenchin Roshi's book, Entering the Mind of Buddha. Just to say before I begin, great compassion vows live in the hearts of bodhisattvas. And by becoming concentrated in their vows, bodhisattvas settle deeply into them, protect, and finally become one with them. So, supported by the power of concentration, they're able to stand steadfast in an unstable world and act in accord with their vows no matter what happens. You can take that, I'm just thinking about that myself, that you can take that on a global level to act in accord with their vows no matter what happens globally, but also on a day-to-day basis to act in accord with their vows no matter what happens, so that they stay with their practice no matter what happens. And this is really very sophisticated ability. Some people are just swept away by whatever comes up and they can't find a place for their zazen even in their morning, you know, or their day altogether. The essence of training in concentration is letting go of discursive thought. The resulting mind, I'm sure you've heard this probably a million times, the resulting mind is not blank. It has a clear orientation, one of realizing peace and freedom for all beings. But as our concentration deepens, it opens to the reality that we're not practicing alone and that our practice is the same practice and the same enlightenment as all beings. We begin this practice by being generous, the first paramita. And this includes being generous with our mind even when we are distracted. And when we're generous this way, we not only become more tranquil, but we make the practice of tranquility a gift for the welfare of all beings. So how do we make it a gift? We give away the merit. So generosity is embedded in the procedure right from the beginning. We offer the merit of our practice of tranquility to the benefit of all beings. And then we use our training in ethics, the second paramita, to consider whether we're trying to get something out of our practice. It's not ethical to take what's not given. So to try to gain anything other than what comes to us through our practice is an ethical infraction. Sawaki Roshi said, "No gain is the most beautiful aspect of human beings. Why? Because no other creature has the option. Cats, dogs, birds, and beasts all must get food and shelter and ensure that source is sustainable all day long. human beings can beg. We don't do that anymore, but really, but giving the merit of generosity to her providers, that was the basis of begging. Actually, the people who offered, there was a lot of merit in offering food to monastics. We human beings can beg, they can save up for periods of time or consciously do without for periods of time. So it's different. It's different being a human being from an animal. Next, we're developing patience, the third paramita, to be present with whatever comes. And now we notice if we're trying to get away from painful feelings of either body or mind. If we are, we can identify those efforts and study and learn from them. So let's take an inventory of our pain to be really conscious of what's going on for ourselves. Fourth, we feel joy at the thought that we are practicing and have energized and sustained our enthusiasm for practice, the fourth paramita. And all of this can be put toward deepening our concentration. When practicing Zazen, it's good to check regularly if we're practicing together with this cohort of practices, the first four paramitas, generosity, ethical behavior, patience, and joyful effort. So the word discursive comes from a Latin root meaning wandering back and forth. Some people think training in concentration involves suppressing discursive thinking, but it's more accurate to say that it results from generously letting go of discursive thought. So we're not pretending that they're not there, or pushing them down or away. We're letting them go. It's a different energy. I really like Ushiana Roshi's opening the hand of thought. That's really exactly the right spirit of letting go of your discursive thoughts. So it's not suppressing, it's just allowing them to drift away. Just to be clear, discursive thought in the context of Zazen includes logical reasoning, planning, argumentation, intuition, imagination, daydreaming, and all kinds of wandering thoughts. It basically includes all patterns of conceptual thinking. So in developing concentration, we simply let these things go. And it can be fun, actually, because we take our thoughts so seriously normally, to just like go identify it as a thought. Oh, thought. And then just let it go. Just drop it right in the middle of itself. So in Bodhisattva meditation, which is Zazen, thinking is not eliminated and it's not grasped. So neither one, where we realize thinking is going on and we don't hold on to it. That's the basic rule. And I love Akiko. She was the young disciple of Sawaki Roshi. And when asked by a fellow monk how she felt about it being a young girl amidst all these men doing like really serious Zazen, she said, "Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. At some point, they disappear without my being aware. I just love that is the very perfect way. Thoughts, clouds come, so it's like clouds. Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. So they come and go with no mind. At some point, they disappear without my being aware. That is the exact correct way to deal with discursive thinking. Do you remember who she is? I'll just repeat her short story. She, after graduating from a prestigious high school, she got this illness called spinal caries. I'm not sure really what that is. At which point she started to move her heart toward Christ or the Buddha. And she made several false starts that didn't quite work until she found Sawaki Roshi, and she asked permission to go with him to Daijiji, where he was teaching. And her practice within its severe schedule was impeccable. She's just this young high school graduate, basically. And she also attended sesshins at branch temples, following all the rules of practice. But at one of those sesshins, an influenza epidemic had spread. And before this, her health was really improving. But at that point, her spinal caries returned. And she was sitting on her bed when Sawaki Roshi visited. And she said, I am practicing for my death, she said, and she put her hands in prayer pose. I have one request. This is the last time we will meet in this world. Can you bestow on me the three refuges? And Sawaki immediately put his hands together and said, repeat after me. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And when Akiko finished repeating after him, she continued sitting on her bed and quietly stopped breathing. It reminds me of Trudy Dixon, a close disciple of Suzuki Roshi, who she was the one who worked on Zen mind, beginner's mind, dividing it into sections according to emphasis and making the titles and the epigraphs that follow the titles. So she did all that. And despite having terminal cancer, she went to Tassajara. And in a talk Roshi gave in, this is Suzuki Roshi gave in 1969, he said he had just come back from visiting one of his closest disciples, Trudy Dixon, who was practicing Zazen while on her deathbed. And I think that she attained enlightenment. And Roshi once said that he never thought he would have a disciple like her. So in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha says, I am always thinking. So the Buddha is thinking, how may I lead all living beings to enter the unexcelled path and quickly to perfect the Buddha body? This discursive thought is always present in Buddha's deep tranquility without disturbing it. Buddha may think, may all beings be happy and may all beings quickly enter the Buddha way. But they don't grasp those thoughts. Instead, they offer them as gifts. Dogen Zenji taught that the thought of bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, is present in bodhisattvas from its first arising till its final realization in Buddhahood. So there is thinking from the beginning to the end of the path, but there is no grasping. So let's just pause for a second this thing called the mind of awakening, or one's first thought of enlightenment. It's very important, obviously, because it jumpstarts the whole endeavor of serious Buddhist practice. But it not only does that, but it supports it minute by minute all the way through. But what is it? What is the mind of awakening? And I just wanted to share that, I don't think I can speak for anyone else, but for myself, it was a fleeting moment while I was living at Zen Center after one Saturday morning lecture. I was leaving the Zendo, the Dharma Hall, actually the Dharma Hall, not the Zendo, the Dharma Hall. And I had this thought, and it felt very vague and far-fetched, but also kind of warm and exciting. And the thought was, I wonder if I could attain enlightenment. And that led to some musing, bringing the teachings very much home to me. And after that, I listened in a different way, and I heard everything more personally. And once that happened, it never, even for a moment, changed, actually. And later I thought, oh, that must be the mind of awakening. You know, I mean, maybe it's not, but who knows? But I thought that. And when I realized that, I had to ask, but when I thought that and realized that, I had to ask myself, well, do you want this for yourself, or do you want this for all beings? Because bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, for a Zen student in the Mahayana, must be for all beings. And after some struggle, I realized that it was so, because without all beings, my own enlightenment wouldn't mean anything. So for better or for worse, I mean, maybe this isn't what I think it is. That was my experience. And it's funny how quick one thought can be so powerful. Even our great ancestor Bodhidharma, we talked about him one or more series ago, encouraged pacifying our minds without contrivance. So we can do this in many ways: playing hockey, making breakfast, practicing ballet, learning to play the flute. It's worth being creative, because we need this skill. Our spiritual futures rely on it. So Bodhidharma called it pacifying our minds without contrivance. So it's ways other than Zazen to get this concentrated mind. And here's a technique used for letting go of thoughts in Zazen. So first we repeat, in posture, there is just posture. In breathing, there is just breathing. And then noticing our breath move through us, we can simply enjoy it without focusing on it. Just noticing and enjoying it. And through the mindfulness of breathing, that nourishes upright posture in itself. And through the mindful attention to posture, discursive thought is more likely to be released, and our mind and body become more subtle and soft and focused. So just to be aware that mindful breath, posture, and releasing discursive thought go together. So that's one tip. And then when pain is a distraction, some ways to think about it are, first, neither liking nor disliking, and simply welcoming and being patient with it. Relaxation will follow a compassionate response. This is to your pain. And you can also study your pain in relation to your mind when it's focused on pain and when it's not focused. Sometimes you can be having pain, and if you deliberately don't focus on it, what is that like versus deliberately focusing on it and just knowing what the difference is? And also remember Tenzin Roshi's description of three different types of pain. There's one that you know from experience that this pain does not damage your body, so you can confidently and responsibly continue to sit. And then the second one, you know from experience that this pain may be harmful. And so you can begin trying to adjust your posture, but if that doesn't work, to responsibly stop sitting. And then the third one, you don't know, you're not sure whether it's a kind of pain that is medically not advised for you, in which case you should stop. But if you don't know, you should act like it's the harmful kind, so that you don't ever sit through harmful pain. We should remember that we do not practice Zazen to make ourselves into excellent meditators, to experience tranquility, or even to acquire insight. We vow to be in the world in a way that offers our practice as a gift to the mountains and rivers, great earth, and all beings. That's all we're doing. We're not trying to make ourselves into excellent meditators. We're not trying to experience tranquility. We're not trying to acquire insight. We're just practicing Zazen and offering the practice as a gift to all beings. So on this note, Reb tells this story of a yogi named Bahia, who was revered and honored as a worthy one. But when he was alone, he wondered whether his understanding was complete. And while he was thus wondering, a deity came to him and told him that his understanding was not mature, but that there was an awakened one who could help him. So immediately Bahia set off to meet the Buddha. And as it would happen, he met the Buddha when the Buddha was with his disciples begging. And Bahia nevertheless asked for teachings for his long-term well-being, welfare and bliss. And the Buddha replied, "Now is not a good time, Bahia. We are engaged in begging." And Bahia said, "We don't know what danger awaits us. Please teach me for my long-term welfare and bliss." And again, the Buddha responded, "This is not a good time, Bahia." And Bahia persisted. He requested teachings from the Buddha a third time and said, "We don't know what danger awaits us. Please teach me for my long-term welfare and bliss." And after hearing Bahia's third request, the Buddha began to teach him and said, "Okay, this is a very important teaching. So I'm going to read it slowly. Herein, Bahia, You should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. So no add-ons, basically. When, and he continues for one more paragraph. When, Bahia, for you, in the seen is merely what is seen, in the cognized is merely what is cognized, then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So in this story, Bahia entered into perfect wisdom immediately. And then the Buddha went away, and not long afterwards, Bahia died when he accidentally got in between a mother water buffalo and her calf. But before that, Bahia realized the Buddha's teaching when it was given to him, and he offered also this teaching for us. So good thing he was persistent. He got the teachings in the nick of time. These instructions sound simple, but they're really hard to practice. It's just really about meeting phenomena wholeheartedly without adding and subtracting anything with our thoughts, desires, or judgments. So we see an object and we say, well, I was telling you, when I see people on the street, rather than judging them for this and that, I go, oh, there's a sentient being. So that's it. There's a sentient being. A bird chirps, you know, there's a sound. There's a sound. There's a person. There's a thought. And that's all. It stops there. That's what the teaching is. That's all the teaching means. It's really quite simple. It's our making it into, oh, there's a sentient being. Look at how ugly she's dressed. Probably this and that. None of that. There's no likes and dislikes. There's no being attracted or unattracted. There's no discursive thoughts afterwards, just sentient being, thought, sound, taste. So in this practice, wisdom arises spontaneously with concentration, in this practice that I just said. Sometimes we think of concentration as one thing and wisdom as another, but here we're speaking of the perfection of concentration that goes beyond itself and is united with wisdom. This concentration is the Dharma gate of peace and freedom for all beings. When we see sights and hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, all duality is transcended, and our concentration practice naturally opens into wisdom. And here, I'd like to offer you a practice. So talking about concentration as a perfection, which combines it with wisdom, there's in Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which was written in the 7th century. He has a practice called equalizing and switching self and other. So equalizing and switching self and other. And this practice is highly recommended by the Dalai Lama. And I'd like to read you some verses from this practice, which grounds an ultimate truth into a behavior we can easily do. And in fact, it's very much like love your neighbor as yourself, which is a Torah rule that Jesus upheld. So this is a practice not only recommended by Jesus, but recommended by Shantideva, a 7th century saint, really, in his Buddhist saint and poet. So here are just a few of his verses on this practice of equalizing and switching self and other, which is the same as love thy neighbor as yourself. First, I should apply myself to meditation on the equality of self and others, because we are all equal in wanting to experience happiness and avoid suffering. I should cherish all beings as I do myself. Although there are many different parts of the body, such as the arms and the legs, we protect all these parts as equally as we protect the body itself. In a similar way, although there are many different living beings, I should cherish them all as equally as I cherish myself. The suffering I experience does not harm others, but I find it hard to bear because I cherish myself. Likewise, the suffering of others does not harm me, but if I cherish others, I shall find their suffering hard to bear. Therefore, I should dispel other sufferings simply because it is suffering just like mine. And I should bring happiness to others simply because they are living beings just like me. If both I and others are the same in that we wish for happiness, what is so special about me that I work only for my own happiness? And if both I and others are the same in that we wish to avoid suffering, what is so special about me that I protect myself but not others? But why should I protect others if their suffering does me no harm? If we cherish only others, we find their suffering hard to bear. So we definitely need to protect them. This is still Shantideva. It is not a wrong conception to think that it will be I who experiences the future suffering, because it will not be another person who dies and yet another who is reborn. And he quotes that someone saying, surely whenever there is suffering, it should be dispelled by whoever is experiencing it. And he answers that, then, since the suffering of the foot is not the hand's, why should the hand help to alleviate it? We alleviate the suffering of the foot with the hand because it is a specific method to relieve this pain. It is also incorrect to grasp and an independent self and others. Such grasping should be completely abandoned. That's all I'll read from that. Tenchin Roshi ends, all Buddhists practice together with each of us. Our great ancestor Dogen encouraged us to remember this. this being all Buddhist practice together with each of us. Whether we remember this or not, the Buddhas are constantly practicing together with us, and their practice is the same as ours. We are each working on something, making some particular effort, and our personal effort is imperceptibly pervading all things and is pervaded by all things. No matter what we are doing, it is thus. This is the sitting meditation of all Buddhas. So here are some of the most important points. The first one is Sawaki Roshi's, no gain is the most beautiful aspect of human beings. Why? Because no other creature has the option. Cats, dogs, birds, and beasts all must get food and shelter to ensure that the source is sustainable all day long. Human beings can beg, save up for periods of time, or consciously do without for periods of time. It's different. Second, when practicing Zazen, it's good to check regularly to be sure we're practicing it together with its whole cohort of practices. The first four paramitas, generosity, ethical behavior, patience, and joyful effort. And third, it can be fun just for once not to take thoughts seriously, because we always take them so seriously, but they're just thoughts churned out by our ever tireless thought machine. Fourth, Buddhas may think, may all beings be happy and may all beings quickly enter the Buddha way, but they don't grasp those thoughts. Instead, they offer them as gifts. Fifth, we do not practice Zazen to make ourselves into excellent meditators, to experience tranquility, or even to acquire insight. We vow to be in the world in a way that offers our practice as a gift to the earth and all living beings. And finally, Dogen Zenji taught that the thought of bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, is present in bodhisattvas from its first arising to its final realization in Buddhahood. So there is thinking from the beginning to the end of the path, but there is no grasping. And here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. First, while it's not ethical to take what's not given, so trying to gain anything other than what comes to us through our practice is an ethical infraction, most of us still practice Zazen with some idea of gain. So what's yours? This is the first question. What is your idea of gain when you practice Zazen? Making your motivations conscious, even though not ideal, is preferable to keeping them unconscious. Second, why not take a pain inventory right now of your pain during Zazen? List pain that you experience in your body and separately pain that you experience in your mind. And as a second step, you might note the varying degrees, like on a scale of 1 to 10. And afterwards, you should study what you've written as a way of becoming even more intimate with your pain. So just you can have a document for pain. And just what is your pain during Zazen, physical and mental? And third, in Bodhisattva meditation, which is Zazen, thinking is not eliminated and it is not grasped. That's the basic rule. It's not eliminated and it's not grasped. But what are you thinking during Zazen? So outside of Zazen, it's okay to think about what's bothering you. And if you think about these things consciously, maybe you won't need to think about them during Zazen. So the third question is, what are you thinking about during Zazen? The fourth one is this idea of Akiko's, just what she said about her thoughts during Zazen. Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. At some point, they disappear without my being aware. Just memorize, if you can, these words of hers, describing her relationship with her thoughts during Zazen, and try to emulate them if you can. It's the very perfect way to relate to your thoughts. And fifth, even our great ancestor Bodhidharma encouraged practicing pacifying our minds without contrivance. So what are some of your own personal ways? I listed a couple. Making breakfast for some people, running for some people, playing a musical instrument. What are some of your ways of pacifying your mind without contrivance? And this, finally, this last thought, I'm suggesting that you pin on your refrigerator, which is, we do not practice Zazen to make ourselves into excellent meditators, to experience tranquility, or to acquire insight. We vow to be in the world in a way that offers our practice as a gift to the great earth and all beings. I wonder if there are questions.
Yes, Gail, there's a couple of questions here. The first one is, in a Zendo meal chant we recite daily, we reflect on whether our virtue and practice are worthy of receiving this offering. While I realize the importance of this concept within Zazen, or otherwise, it seems to imply more guilt than I would otherwise expect. Could you comment?
yes. You know, that's exactly, this teaching in the seen will be merely the seen, and in the heard will be merely the heard. So in the heard will be merely the heard. We receive this meal considering whether our virtue and practice deserve it. I can't remember exactly the whole thing, but that's basically the idea. And you're saying guilt. But the words are, considering whether our virtue and practice deserve it, there actually isn't any guilt in that statement. When I used to chant that every single day, I loved that part of it. And it always made me reflect on, you know, anything I had done that day that I wish I hadn't done. And then if I already am making amends, you know, this confession and regretting that you did something of any wrongdoing, that melts away the wrongdoing. So the consciousness of considering whether your virtue and practice deserve it, making that conscious, and then asking for forgiveness. Guilt doesn't have to be in that picture at all. I wanted to say one more thing. There's actually three levels in our relationship with anything. So the first is when, and this is a Buddhist teaching, that there are three levels in our relationship with anything. And the first is just the thing itself. We hear this statement, when we receive this food, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. That's the statement. And then the second level is we take it in and we start having likes and dislikes about it, or aversion or guilt or something like that. That's the second level. And then the third level, so we become more interconnected with it. And the third level, let's say it's an object in a store, and we buy it and we take it home, and then we feel like it's ours, and we own this thing. And that's the third level of interrelating with an object. And this statement of the Buddha's to Bahia, in the heard will just be heard, in the seen will just be seen. He's saying, skip all other levels. Skip the second level where you start having likes and dislikes or opinions or questions, and skip the third level where you start actually having this interpersonal sense of ownership. All of that should go, and we stay simply with what the seen will just be the seen, and the heard will just be the heard. So you could even go, even in that meal chant, you could even take in the words and see them as just words. You could even go that The meal chant is just the meal chant. And so we say these things even without acting on them, even though it sounds like we should be acting on them. It's all right to just chant the meal chant, and that's all. And you put it down, and you've chanted the meal chant. And whatever is in there has gone out into the world. And I'm sure in there is gratitude for receiving the food. And that's all. End of story. I know it seems a little severe, but it's our likes and dislikes and that lead to our grasping, which lead to a new birth and then another incarnation of death. So we're going to talk about this at length in our next series, but the Buddha is giving Bahia this incredible teaching that we too can practice. And it starts with, in the scene will just be the scene, sort of like I was telling you a while back, I realized how judgmental I am when I see people on the street, and I started doing this practice of, oh, there's a sentient being. Oh, there's a sentient being. Oh, look, there's a sentient being. Just to kind of stop myself. And I realize it's exactly the same as this practice that Buddha gave Bahia of, in the scene will just be the scene. Walking down the street, there's a sentient being. Stop. You know, there's a thought. Stop. There's a sound. Stop. I hope I answered your question. I think I answered some other questions too. Thank you for asking, and I hope that that helps you.
The next question, Gail, is, isn't Buddhism a path to end suffering? If so, can we practice Zazen to end suffering?
Yes, that's why we practice Zazen. That's exactly why we practice Zazen, to end suffering, to end the suffering of all beings. Yes.
Maybe they're asking as if it conflicts with we should practice Zazen for no reason.
Oh, well.
Or that makes me think that anyway.
You know, I think that it's true that we practice Zazen for no reason, but especially no personal reason. I think that if we practice Zazen for the well-being of the great earth and the mountains and the rivers and all beings, that it's all right. It's a large enough impersonal wish for everyone's welfare. I think it's all right. And I think actually that's the intention, but it's not a personal intention, even though we are included in all beings. It's true. I don't have anything else to say about that.
Thank you. That was the last of the questions in the Q&A box for now.
Let's see. There's one. I've noticed this question, and I have an answer that I think is important. So this person said, I'm sorry to ask again, as you've already explained, But why is no gain so important in Zen? And I want to explain again that when we focus on gain, we're focusing on gain for someone. And who is that someone? Myself. And but the I doesn't exist. We only exist in interconnection with other beings, not from our side. So we exist in interconnection with all beings, but we don't exist from our side. So when we focus on gain in Zazen, then we turn it into a delusive purpose. Because there is no I to gain anything. But I want to say one more thing about this. It might help to make it even more clear. When the great ones examined the body and mind, they found only parts, the parts of the body and parts of the mind, but there was no I to hold those parts together. So the parts exist, but there's no I to hold them all together. And so they said no I can be found. But this does not mean that it doesn't exist. It only means there's no inherent existence. There's a big difference here. There's no inherent existence. There's existence, but no inherent existence. So there's no separate I separated out from this whole mass of existence. There's interconnection. There's an interconnected existence, but there's no I like separated out who owns this thing and that thing. So there's existence, but no inherent existence. So sometimes when you hear the I doesn't exist, it means the I has no inherent existence. It really mean that there's no existence. I know it can sound confusing. That's why I wanted to explain. When there's gain, gain is usually attached to this I, myself, but that's an I myself that's not, that doesn't inherently exist. So that's why we try to discourage gain, a gaining mind in Zazen. But one of the reflection questions was, you know, probably there is an idea of gain. We're all young. We're all just babies. We're baby Zazen practitioners, all of us. And so we're going to have gain. You know, we have all these things. So to get conscious about it, that was my only point. And not to be ashamed of, you know, we have to start somewhere. So we just start at the beginning and we are like really babies. Baby Buddhist practitioners. Well, we're out of time, and I want to thank my team, especially today, Brian and Brendan and Sahar, who is in Pakistan without electricity and so was not able to attend today. And I want to thank you people for being here. And also the people who listen in during the week. Thank you all so much. You make these talks possible, and I'm really grateful. Bye-bye for today.